Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And you as an upstart, do you ever feel like you're sabotaging your own success? Jason Gaynard says that he used credit cards to build TicketsCanada.com into a $3 million business. And then he did something to screw it up and ended up deep in debt. He says he sabotaged his own success. I want to find out how he did it and why someone would sabotage their own success. I also want to hear about his latest business, which is called Mastermind Talks, which connects entrepreneurs with each other and lets them learn from each other. All this is sponsored by Walker Corporate Law. One of my fans recently said, Andrew, I don't care about your sponsorship of Walker Corporate Law. I want you to get into the action. So I'm going to get into the action right now with Jason. Jason, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
At your height, you and your girlfriend took a trip to the Bahamas. Terrific. You then come home, and 3 weeks later, you fly back. Why do you fly back?
I fell in love with the Bahamas rather quickly. I fell in love with the people of the Bahamas. And while down there the first time, I asked some of the locals, if you live in quote-unquote paradise, where do you go to vacation? And some of them gave me the New Yorks and the San Franciscos of the world, but a lot of them said an island called Eleuthera, which was a sister island that was 15 minutes away by plane. So my wife and I just at the time, or girlfriend, now wife, decided to go back 3 weeks later, and I just fell in love with it.
Why?
That was actually the first place I've lost track of time. It's Lenny Kravitz lives on the island. He's there most of the year. He walks around in flip-flops amongst the locals and stuff like that. It's a really unique place. And for me, being an entrepreneur, being very connected to my phone, you know, the minute you wake up in the morning, first thing you turn to is check your emails and stuff like that, especially if you're an online e-commerce business, you're looking to see how many orders you got. That was the first place I lost track of time. And
what does it mean to lose track of time?
Literally lose track of time, like in the sense like as far as always being connected, I always knew exactly what time it was. I was always rushing against the
clock. I see. You're just so enjoying yourself that you're not thinking about what you're going to do next. You're not worried about the future. You're just there, 100%. Present with your girlfriend in this environment. And you didn't just stay there. You ended up buying something. What'd you buy?
I bought some land. I bought some property down there. I fell in love with the place. And we were there for 9 days the first time we went down there. And by probably the fifth or sixth day, I just kept on seeing real estate signs all over the place. And I'm like, I wonder how much it costs to own a piece of paradise. And it was a lot cheaper than I thought it would be. And the first time I was down there, I bought two properties, and I've been back many times since.
What's it cost to buy land there? Buy water?
If ocean front, you're looking probably about $150,000 for a lot.
So you're spending not $1 million, but you're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy it. Do you feel rich at that point? Do you feel like, I am rich in love? I'm a guy who couldn't date earlier in my life, and now I've got this girl who I'm really in love with. I'm a guy who actually can finally enjoy the trip that he's on. I've done it. This is it. Did you feel that at all?
I had the freedom of time and money, and that's something I was blessed with in that last business, that I could do what I want, when I want, wherever I want. I mean, I couldn't buy $1 million house in cash, but, you know, I could buy, if I want to buy a fancy car, I could buy one in cash and that kind of stuff. I was in a very fortunate position at the time. That could have been seen as an aha moment that I've quote unquote made it. But I was building up, and over time, I just started to get this mindset that whatever I wanted financially, I could simply afford.
That's a good feeling.
I could find a way.
All right. The guy who complained earlier via email that I shouldn't keep promoting Walker Corporate Law or talk about anything other than business, his name is Phil. I got to keep this interview on track for Phil. So what Phil would probably want to know, we'll find out, is about your business beginnings. And one of the things that I heard is that you're a guy who, even at an early age, you delivered flyers for a lawn cutting business, right?
I did.
And what did you learn back then about that we could apply today and that will make Phil very happy that he's learned something about business?
Well, I mean, in that business, so I was probably like 12, 13 at the time. Like most entrepreneurs, I showed entrepreneurial traits at a young age. And one thing I did is I created this flyer in like Microsoft Word, and I got it printed out, probably like 500 flyers, and I hand delivered like 450 of them. I got no responses. And then on the last 50, I said, you know what, I'm going to write a handwritten note at the bottom saying, listen, I'm 12 years old, looking to make some extra money, those kind of things. And I hand delivered that batch, and I got a response rate probably of like 12 to 15 people on that last 50. And to me, it really demonstrated the power of vulnerability in marketing, because especially in business, especially when you're starting out, oftentimes you want to, you want to project that you're bigger than you really are, right? You want that address, you want that nice fancy website, those kind of things. But sometimes people don't connect to that, and sometimes that authenticity really shines through and will really help in a marketing situation. I think that you're starting to see especially with social media and stuff like that, you're starting to see that transparency be very, very important.
There you go, Phil. On the bottom of your website, I want you to say, I'm a 12-year-old guy trying to make it in this world. Please subscribe to my newsletter or sign up to my web app. So obviously, the school system is there to foster education, to make us all better. I imagine you went to school. You said, I have this new passion for entrepreneurship. And they said, let's help you out here, right? Let's make you really love school. Is that what happened?
You definitely did do your research. I dropped out of school. In my last year, just about getting into my last year, I dropped out. I was a terrible student. The only thing I was good at was like shop class. That was pretty much it.
Actually, you know what? So much of what you said about your past makes me almost feel like you are setting up a backstory that shows everyone else that you deserve to be where you are today. But shop class doesn't fit in with any of that. What's the deal with shop class?
I was good with my hands. I mean, I guess I'm a kinesthetic learner to a certain degree, and just being able to use my hands was always great. And I mean, in school, I just was not engaged. I didn't like the format of it per se. I never felt like I belonged. I skipped a lot of high school to work. I had a full-time job through high school, so sometimes I'd miss 2-3 weeks at a time to work, and I'd get all kinds of flack when I came back to school. So eventually, when I came of age, I said, you know what, school's just simply not for me. And I decided to leave.
Did you make any money doing all this?
I was working through school. I was making a ton of money because I was working full time, making 17, 18 bucks an hour when you're 16, 17, working 40, 45 hours a week. It's pretty good money when you have no overhead, right? So I was the guy with the nice car and that kind of stuff throughout high school. And
I see. Did you save any of it, or was it all spent?
Oh, I blew it all. I mean, every paycheck I got at the time was going towards my car at the time. I'm all in or I'm all out, one or the other, and it's one of those things that wherever I go all in, my bank account follows. So it was I think it was like paintball, and it was like, you know, cars when I could get a car and that kind of stuff. So
why do you think you do that? Was it because you wanted to really enjoy all these things and you couldn't control yourself, or did you want attention from other people?
I think it was a significance thing to a certain degree, because I wasn't necessarily the popular kid. I was the funny kid, but I wasn't the popular guy. And I could buy my popularity to a certain degree by getting the nice car. And then now I've never thought about it, but looking back on it, I think that was definitely a strong motivator. It was really a way to stand out, because not a lot of kids in that environment have a lot of money. Okay. So again, when you're making...
Did it work?
I had a girlfriend.
You did?
And it did work to a degree.
Okay.
I've always been that mindset of, like, if there's a will, there's a way. Like, anything I wanted, no matter what, even my bank account doesn't match it, I'll find a way. Okay. I'm just one of those people by nature. But I guess it worked to a certain degree. I mean, people remember me, but I definitely could have saved some money to start a business.
Did it create some kind of magnetism too, you know, that when the success, I feel, breeds success largely because you feel so proud of your success that you show the world this confidence, and then they want to do work with you and so on, and they want to date you. Did you feel that was happening to you?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely felt, and the more money I spent and stuff like that, I never got into partying and that kind of stuff because I did work so much, but it definitely felt like the more money I was kind of flashy with at the time, the more response I got from people. And it's interesting that thinking about this, because it makes me wonder if that was my first taste of money and that's how it led to my business and how I would, my spending habits in that business. I've never thought about that.
And so... I'm so curious about this self-sabotage. I feel like I'm overly protective, you know, that the idea of self-sabotage, I know it's an issue because people in my audience tell me about it, but I always feel helpless because I don't know how to help them because I don't even understand the problem. So take me back to this period where life is so good. You got a girlfriend, which frankly I would have killed for in high school. You got a car, which I wouldn't have. I was driving a little old huge Volvo. I might have used a better car, but I don't get why you'd want to sabotage it. Did you at that point feel like you have to sabotage it?
Not at that point.
No, at that point you were good.
at that point, I was good. Okay. And then I left school and became a mechanic and did that for a little bit. And then I started my first business.
Become a mechanic? Why'd you go into that as opposed to starting more businesses and really being this entrepreneur?
Because I was good with my hands, and I naturally gravitated to cars because I had money and I would do things to my car. So I just, you know, when I decided to leave school, that was the one thing I kind of gravitated towards. And I did enjoy it from a certain degree because of the creativity, because I did automotive performance modifications to vehicles and stuff like that. So okay. It wasn't maintenance work. So it was enjoyable. But I definitely wasn't rolling in money in that job. I was literally clearing probably like $550 every 2 weeks. And one day I was doing that for about a year and a bit. And then one day over lunch, for some crazy reason, I decided to do an interesting calculation, which was my, basically the national average life expectancy, which was like 80 years at the time. And I multiplied that by 365 days. And when I took my age, which was 18, and I multiplied that by 365 days, I found out that I had lived, quote unquote, 6,500 out of the 28,000 days if you live all 80 years.
Okay.
And for me, that created, for the first time in my life, a sense of urgency that I'm not going to be here forever. Because when you're 18, you think 80 years is so far away. But when I saw it in perspective of days, it's really changed everything for me. And that day I quit the job. It was a Thursday. And by next week, I had another job, which was actually, oddly enough, in car sales, which which I enjoyed at the time. But then that kind of ventured into my first business, which was the personal concierge business.
Did you learn anything as a car salesman that Phil would be happy with? That we can use to, frankly, actually forget about Phil for a moment, but I always wanted to go into car sales because I feel like they are going into a war zone with the enemy and convincing the enemy to give them money, right? People don't go in there going, I love these people, I'll just buy a car and give them all my money. No, they're battling, and still the car salesman can persuade them. Do you have one tip that you learned from that I as a salesperson can use when I promote Walker Corporate Law or Mixergy Premium?
Well, I mean, in car sales, there's a lot of downtime. That's one thing for sure. But for me, if I'm looking back, I think one of the biggest takeaways was I was there for about a month and a half, and I became quickly one of the best salesmen there, or the highest. I had the most sales during the month, and so I was there. And really, I think the reason why is because I'm a firm believer that conventional methods yield conventional results. And when people would come in, all the sales guys would attack them the same way. And it was very, I mean, people had their guard up and they knew exactly how these people were going to attack. And for me, I took a different approach, and I was very kind of approachable. And I actually did the research for them. So if people were, I was working for an Acura dealership, when people came in to buy an Acura, I knew they were probably looking at a specific model of BMW, they're probably looking at a specific model of Honda, those kind of things. So what I do is I actually created these books, which had all the research in it, which had all the, like, back then it was Edmunds, I don't know if they still have it now, which is all the reviews of cars, of people who own the cars. They say, you know, this is great or this is terrible, those kind of things. And I just hand it to them and I say, listen, this is a great vehicle, but here's you're going to do the research anyways. I'm going to make it easy for you. It's right here, right? And we'll talk about it. And because of that kind of that transparency, I think that really resonated with people, and that's what made my job a lot easier than just kind of pitching hard. So if I look back at it, conventional methods yield conventional results, and I think that can be applied in various areas of business and life.
Okay. And if you know that the person you're selling is going to get some kind of ammunition, might as well hand it over to them if they're going to get it anyway.
100%. I mean, the sales game has definitely changed, and I know Dan Pink talks about it a lot in his last book, right? I mean, the information has really shifted, and now you can, if you're using cars as an example, I mean, now you can go online and find out the true MSR, like the true cost that a dealer is paying for a vehicle, and you could put that on the table and be like, I'll pay $500 above cost. And there's nothing, there's nothing the dealer can say per se, right? So it's definitely changed. So people are going to do the research regardless. So might as well just be transparent and not try to hide anything.
Okay. The concierge business, I want to spend a little bit of time on that before we go on to the ticket business, which is the heart of the success and self-sabotage. But you got into personal concierge because you saw that people were wasting their time coming into your dealership to buy cars. And you said, well, if they keep coming back in doing all this research, maybe I as a concierge can do it for them and they pay me and there's big business there. What kind of concierge services beyond shopping for cars did you do for people?
Well, that was the initial business idea, was to do a car shopping service to a certain degree. But then, like most entrepreneurs, you want to be everything to everyone. So I decided to do virtually anything at an hourly rate to a certain degree. And our slogan for the business was, if it was legal, moral, and would save you time, we take care of it. Okay. So we did do some car shopping stuff, but the majority of the stuff we did was like people's grocery shopping. I broke up with somebody's girlfriend once. I've watered people's trees. I hand delivered wedding invitations in a tuxedo across, like, you know, 400 kilometer radius in Toronto and stuff like that. So I would do pretty much anything and everything that, as long as it had some kind of morality to it, for 50-60 bucks an hour. So we did everything. And then how that transpired into the ticket business was, from a positioning perspective, when people thought of the word concierge, they thought of hotel concierge. And when they thought of hotel concierge, they thought of concert tickets. And so we started sourcing concert tickets, and we kept on going to these big brokers locally, and they just charged these huge, huge fees, which we in turn had to pass on to our customers. And it was bothersome to me, so I started stocking our own little inventory, not thinking anything of it, just trying to save our customers some money. But over time, that inventory kept on growing and growing and growing, until one point that side of the business started to eclipse the personal concierge side. And I realized quickly in that business too that service-based businesses are very hard to scale. So when I saw the money coming in from the product side with the ticketing side, it was an easy decision to kind of jump ship from the concierge side of the business.
I see. When you say that they had this big margins, was it that they were buying tickets to the local game and then selling it for 20 to 30% more?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, 300-400% more often.
That's what I figured. We're talking huge numbers. So then when you start buying it, what happens when you buy tickets expecting that your concierge customers are going to want to buy it from you, and some of them eventually just don't get sold? What do you do with them?
So that's the core reason why the ticket prices are so inflated, is because there is quite a few, you do get quite a few losses in that business. And if there's a way to kind of crack that to a certain degree, I mean, definitely that would bring down the prices substantially. So that's kind of that. And what we did, which no other brokers did really, is that we would donate them to charity. So if it was the day before the event, we would donate them to like the Ronald McDonald House, so, you know, parents and their kids could go to.
And are there tax benefits of doing that? Am I a scumbag for even wondering that?
No. There is and there isn't. I didn't really dig into it too much. I mean, we donated quite a bit, and I was always terrible at keeping tax receipts. But for me, it was like, you know, we could keep this inventory of 50, 60 tickets for a show tomorrow and maybe get $500, $1,000, you know, tomorrow somehow selling them last minute. Or we just donate them to people who would enjoy them. So that's kind of how we... Our model is that we made as much money as we could, and then 24 hours, 36 hours before the event, we just donated the remainder.
When you were in the concierge business, how'd you get your customers?
Well, initially the hard way. Initially, I hand delivered flyers initially and got zero response. That was the first real failed marketing attempt I ever did. From that point, it really became... The beauty of it was, because I was 18 at the time, and I was in this new emerging industry, it was a great angle from a PR perspective. So I got a lot of press. I got a ton of press, thankfully. And because of that, that really helped quite a bit. And then it was a lot of word of mouth and a lot of just return clientele. So once we had clients that we did work with, they'd use us on a pretty regular basis.
How did you get press as an 18-year-old concierge?
Google. Somebody found our website once, and it's one of those things, like, once you get featured by one publication, you know, we had a full page spread in a newspaper called National Post, which is a national newspaper in Canada. And once we were on there, then after that, the next day, you know, a news station, you know, sees that and says, oh, we should have them on. And then somebody else sees that. It's like this snowball, right? So the hardest piece of press is that first one to get. But once you get the first one, everything just comes into play. So it was based purely on luck and
total position. Luck. But if they saw your website, it didn't say I'm 18 years old, right?
No, actually, it did. It didn't say I was 18 years old, but I had a picture of me as in a tuxedo on the front with probably they saw some spelling mistakes in the description in the About Me page, so maybe they guessed it. I'm not sure, but yeah, I didn't necessarily say I was 18 years old, because again, at the time, I was still trying to project that we're a bigger company, we have many employees, and opening multiple offices and that kind of stuff. But I think many of them probably figured it, and once we were featured in the first one, then others followed pretty easily.
Okay, the company was called VIP Services Inc.
Correct. Yep.
I see. From an old about page, you say VIP Services Inc. was one of the first personal concierge firms in Canada, meaning that there was very little information in the market that told me what I could expect as a personal concierge. My budding experience in this industry quickly led me to create a mission statement for VIP Services. VIP Services will take care of all your legal and moral time. Wait, what is that? Will take care of all your legal and moral time-saving tasks. That was your mission statement.
I don't even know where you found that. Is it way back? I don't know where you found that. I'm gonna take a look myself. It's been a long time. Like I said, it's probably full of stuff.
The way you expressed it now is so much clearer than what you've said here on the site. Here, I'll read the mission statement again. Quote: VIP Services will take care of all your legal and moral time-saving tasks. Where today you said, if it's illegal, ethical, and moral, I will do it for you. Or something.
I gotta show that to my wife, because my wife like proofreads everything I say before it goes out to the public. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna show her that, because she's probably gonna get a good chuckle.
I wanted to look you up. I said, is this guy for real? Am I about? You know what? I was just talking the other night. I had some friends over for poker. At least one of them who I interviewed, and I said, you know, my big issue is I can't allow myself to get snowed like all these other interviewers who will interview some guy who says he's a millionaire and will treat him like royalty, who's going to teach everyone everything. I said, yeah. I am constantly in paranoia about it. That's why I hire researchers. That's why I have people over to my house for poker. He said, really? I thought you just invited me here for fun. I said, no, I'm here to get to know you and see if you're a real human being or not.
Well, that's honorable, because that's a pet peeve of mine as well, is when people position themselves as millionaires, and that's such a vague term. Nobody
right.
knows necessarily.
And then you dig in and you go, well, look, if you include the value of my real estate and my life insurance policy and the fact that how can you measure the value of love, and my wife loves me, so I'm worth $1 million at least. Well, yeah. All right then. Here's my credit card. Sign me up for your webinar about how to make $1 million too.
Yeah.
I want to be like you. Yeah. But, you know, you never know. The guy was Ned from Elto. Ned from Elto. He's a nice guy, but I immediately said, I'm glad you're here for fun. I'm going to make sure you have a good time in my poker game, but I'm here for business. I got to make sure I don't get snowed at work the next day. All right. So I see how this is going. I see how you're growing the business. Can you continue honestly to – actually, no, I take it back. I looked at TicketsCanada.com, the early version. Early version was just a list of links. So was that the first thing that you launched? What did you launch?
So how it transpired is basically initially when we made the move, when we started buying inventory, we became a wholesaling company. And how the ticket industry works, there's a retail side and there's a wholesale side. So the retail side is those front-facing websites that you see.
Okay.
They don't have any inventory. All they do is they share a feed. And the feed comes from brokers like us. So there's about maybe 2,000 wholesalers across North America.
And the wholesalers actually buy the tickets.
They buy the tickets in bulk.
Okay.
And then they just supply the what they have to this feed, and it goes across all these websites. So the eBays and the StubHubs of the world. And then when those websites sell it, then we just get an order, we fill the package and send it out. So we were able to build a pretty big business with a small team, which was nice. And that's how we started, was wholesaling. And then what happened was, over time we started, because really how the industry works is, you know, Ticketmaster is the biggest player in that space. And how it would work is, let's say Ticketmaster sells tickets for $100. But as a ticket broker, you say, you know what, there's huge demand for this event. There's only one show. You know, it's One Direction or something like that. Really, realistically, it's all guessing. It's almost like gambling. It's almost like the stock market. But you take a good guess as to whether, you know, the demand's going to be high or low. And from that, you purchase a bulk group of tickets. So let's say the cost was $100. That's the face value of the ticket. And you list them up at $200. So if, as long as there's huge demand, people will buy them at $200, you make $100 profit. But over time, you know, I knew I could forecast that Ticketmaster and the promoters of events would get a little smarter with all their data as far as how to price tickets, right? Because we were making up this huge gap. And over time, we were starting to get squeezed more and more on the wholesale side. Mm-hmm. So I said, you know what? No matter what happens on the wholesale side of the business, if you're on the retail side, you make a commission fee. No matter if the holding broker is losing money on the sale or is making money, StubHub makes a flat 20%. eBay makes a flat fee.
And they don't have to buy anything. All they have to do is just do affiliate.
Exactly. It's an affiliate. Exactly. Okay. That's how they work. So I said, well, let's pivot into that business. So we still had the wholesale side of the business, but we pivoted into the retail side.
I was doing some searches to see how you were. I figured that kind of business is probably very SEO heavy, or at least was SEO heavy at the time. Yeah. Was it?
Very black hat SEO. And how it would work oftentimes is that guys would secure domain names for venues and they'd create this like one page website and use very black hat SEO tactics. So they'd have hundreds of these sites and that's how they would use it to generate traffic or to generate sales. And it's a very kind of, it's very pay-per-click heavy business as well. Those were definitely, that was the model of the industry, was you'd acquire the customer through pay-per-click. And let's say that customer cost, you made $50 profit, that customer cost you $20 to acquire, you made $30 in the bank, then you went out and you got your next customer, and then you got your next customer and that kind of stuff. So
which area did you play in most? Was it buying ads or was it SEO black hat?
Couple different things. So because we were the wholesaler, meant that we were shipping all the tickets, that all the orders that were coming in, we would ship the tickets. And when we shipped the tickets, I would put in a flyer, even though it was not allowed, I would put in a flyer for our retail side of the business and say, listen, if you want to cut out the middleman next time, buy right from us. And we'd ship out, 5,000, 10,000 orders a year, probably more than that. But that's how we first kind of helped, and then we did some SEO stuff. It wasn't black hat stuff. I mean, we hired a proper firm, and just because of our domain name at the time, from a positioning standpoint, it was a great domain name. So that helped a lot. That helped quite a bit as well. And then we had a lot of return customers, but definitely for the most part, that during that entire ticketing business, the wholesale side was the biggest generator for us, because we'd buy, sometimes on an individual show, we'd make $50,000-$60,000 profit.
How would you get affiliates?
It's through, so there's different models, but any like a StubHub or something like that, you as the general public can go and list tickets. As a large seller, basically, they give you like an upload feed, and you just upload right to them.
So how do you guys compete with each other? Because if there's a Justin Bieber concert and happens to be popular, you have it, but so does every other wholesaler have it. So how do you compete and make more money than anyone else or stay alive?
So there's a few things that we did differently, which really helped us grow really quickly, much faster than our competitors. One of them was that we were leveraging the currency. So we were based in Canada. We were buying tickets in Canadian currency. They were selling in U.S. currency. And at the time, this has to be 5, 6, 7 years ago, there was probably a difference of 20%, 15 to 20% in the currency exchange. So what all the other brokers were doing is they'd sell tickets and they mark them up, 20, 30, 40, 100%. What we did is we bought tickets and we sold them close to cost, but we sold them and we're banking on the fact that if they purchase, we'd make money on the currency. For a while, we were just churning tickets out faster than anybody else, and we were just making money strictly on currency. And that was a really great model for us because we sold a lot of stuff really, really quickly, and before our competitors could even do anything about it. So that's one kind of model. And then it is very much a commodity game. I mean, you have different seats and different sections, different rows, so you can price accordingly. But it's one of those things that when you're looking at a show and you're trying to value a show, you see how many tickets are amongst all the brokers, and you'll see some are underpriced, and you kind of bank that if they sell theirs really quickly, getting closer to the show, you're going to be the last guy with tickets, so you'll be able to control the market. And also another tactic we use is we bought more tickets than anybody else for very specific shows, so that we would control the market. So we'd have tickets at the lowest price, and we had tickets at the highest price.
How do you get to buy so many tickets?
Well, there are computer programs for that now. Back in the day, we did it old-fashioned way, where we just had multiple windows, and we would buy groups of eight at a time.
You just sit there on your computer. with multiple browser windows open and buy them? And you personally would do it?
I myself, and there was like 3-4 others. I was the one who always made that final decision. So when people pulled up tickets, they call out what they had, and I would make the quick decision whether to purchase or not.
Okay.
We buy
like an old school trading desk, like the New York Stock Exchange. I got 50 tickets to Justin Bieber at $100 each. Should we buy it? Exactly. Yes, taken.
It was a rowdy time.
That's what we're talking about. Okay, so what about how you're paying for it? If you are selling tens of thousands of tickets to one concert, that means you're laying out tens of thousands of dollars to buy those tickets, and you have to wait for that cash to come in. Where does that initial funding come from? It's not the concierge business.
No, it was all credit cards. So how it would work is when we'd buy it on credit cards, and we would, as they would sell on the back end, we would pay the credit card and just kept on buying more and more, and it just created this snowball.
Okay.
And that's how we kind of really built the business. So we kept on reinvesting everything back into the business and paying off credit cards. And as we got better relationships with our credit card companies, they kept on extending credit. And that's how we were able to have access to a lot of credit.
I left Bradford and Reed, my previous company, with 1,000,000 miles because of all the credit card expenses. Did you get miles or any other perk for spending so much?
I did. I don't tell too many people about this, but every year I would cash out. So in Canada, in American Express specifically, they have something called airplane points. I would have basically I would cash them out for American Express gift cards. And the last year I did it, I had $28,000 in gift cards, in American Express gift cards. So I'd use it for travel. I'd use it for all that kind of stuff. And that was definitely a nice perk, was the points for sure.
Okay. What's the funnest thing that you got to buy with that?
I definitely did like the whole flight stuff and that kind of stuff. I was looking to buy a massage chair. I think I probably have about like 3-4 million points a year. And I was going to buy this massage chair. I never ended up pulling the trigger on it. But when I calculated what a point was worth dollar-wise, the best bang for the buck was to convert it into actual gift cards. Yeah. And then once you had gift cards, you could use it for whatever. So,
how long did it take you to make your first $1 million in sales, not profit?
Oh, God. It had to probably in sales, probably. Well, so once we pivoted into the ticket business, we probably did $1 million in the first year.
Okay.
Because again, we just kept on churning and growing really, really quickly. But there was a little bit of a lag between the concierge business and the ticket business. Like it took
concierge
me a while.
Business. How much money does that bring in at its height?
God, it was small. Probably $12,000-$15,000 a month.
Okay.
And
it's all profit, but it's all sweat equity.
So that's revenue. So there's still cost, but I'd say maybe profit wise, like what I'm taking home is probably $4,000.
Okay. And you had employees too. You had other people who were doing it, not just you.
I did. I had one employee, and I dabbled with like contractors and stuff like that. I tried to do as much as I could by myself because I needed the money. We definitely dabbled with some stuff. It wasn't until Tickets Canada where I had a hard time hiring in the concierge business for several reasons. One of the biggest hangups was hiring somebody who's older than me. So my first employee was 29 and I was 18, 19. And that was a tough pill to swallow for me. And then in the ticket business, that's
what
I hired.
What do you mean tough pill? Because you were afraid to, well, why?
Just from a doubt perspective and the fear, just the fear of maybe looking like I don't know what I'm doing, or hiring somebody who's older than me, you know, somebody who's like my parents' age in some cases, or sending me applications, stuff like that. And it was just, for me, it was just, I think it really came down to people doubting me or the fear of people judging me and stuff like that based on my age.
Yeah.
And like I said, that was probably one of the core reasons why I didn't hire that quickly in that business. And I only ended up having one or two hires in that concierge business.
So if you made $1 million in the first year, how much of that would you have taken home as net profit?
Probably, it was pretty good. I mean, we reached a threshold where we were at about, when we were doing about $1.5 million a year, we were probably bringing home about $350,000-$400,000.
Okay.
But reinvesting it all again back into the business. And then when we doubled the business, the one thing we realized is our profit didn't change all that much. So that was a big kind of eye opener for me.
Why not?
I mean, it changed a little bit, but it wasn't. It didn't scale right. Like revenues and profits scale very differently.
Because.
Why?
Why
do they scale differently?
Yeah, why isn't it a one-for-one growth?
The cost involved. When we were doing probably $1.5 million, $2 million a year, we had a small team. There was like three of us, very low overhead, none of that, you know, nothing really, really fancy there. And then when we expanded and grew, then we had more employees, we had more computers, we had Christmas parties, we had... you know, all those kind of things with people calling in sick, like just normal stuff that you have. And then we're also, to take it to that next level, we were dabbling with a lot of unconventional things. So I hired like a full-time videographer to do YouTube videos. This is back in the day when YouTube was just kind of starting out. I had a content writer, a copywriter. I had a guy taking care of internet marketing and stuff like that. So again, like those, if we would have stayed into it, then maybe at one point in time it would have kind of paid off and we would have seen a big spike, I guess, in our bottom line. But yeah, I mean, definitely profits and revenue scale very differently. And you know, it seems like most businesses have this kind of threshold. And if you pass that threshold, then things start to change a bit.
Right. So I've got coaches and people who help me become a better interviewer. And one of the things that I learned is that when the story gets to high, you have to talk about the big challenge right afterwards, or else the person feels like everything, it sounds like everything goes right for the person and no one can relate. And there's no tension, the will he or won't he make attention. So we got to this height. What do you do to sabotage it?
So I mean, there's a few things that happened, but I was never passionate about the industry. I was never passionate about the business. We've sold millions of dollars in hockey tickets. I've never been to a hockey game. It's tough to get behind something you don't believe in. And that was always a kind of a problem, but I was always chasing the money. And then one day, I calculated my actual net income that year and divided by the national average income. And I realized I was making 22 times the national average income. And for me, that was an eye opener because I'm like, I'm not 22 times happier than the average male. When I was 23, 24, I had kidney complications because of stress, because of bad business partnership. And it just became clear to me that money and happiness scale very differently. And I wanted to get out. And I was relatively naive at the time in business as far as like selling the business and those kind of things. And for me, the only way I saw out was to sabotage the business. Mm-hmm. I knew as long as I had a plan B, which was a business that took care of all my wants and needs financially, I'd never fall through with plan A, which was to create a business that would really light me up every day. So, I mean, at the time I didn't see it as sabotage. At the time I just saw it as me scaling down the business and having a soft landing at zero.
Before you go into the two things happen, why would you want a soft land to zero?
It's weird. I think the psychological damage sometimes you get as an entrepreneur. For me, I saw the business as a source of pain after a while. And I felt I was making all this money and I was unfulfilled. And for me, I saw it so much as a source of pain that people who did approach me, like friends and stuff like that, who wanted to have that discussion about, you know, would you sell the business to me? Those kind of things. I didn't even want to entertain the idea because to me, my model in my head at the time was that if I sell the business to, you know, Jake or something like that, and he's going to run into the same issue I'm feeling right now 2 years from now, and I don't want to jeopardize our relationship. And it sounds crazy, but I just thought that people were going to feel the same pain that I was feeling, and that the only way for me to kind of keep that from happening was just to slowly kill the business. And I've had many, many conversations with a lot of entrepreneurs about this, and I had a really good peer network who weren't too familiar with, again, like exits and that kind of stuff, but they're like, what are you doing? You're crazy. You know, sell it off or give it to somebody and stay behind the scenes as a silent partner. And I was definitely stuck in my ways. I really wanted to scale that business downward.
I see it. It's almost like if I have a clunky used car and a friend of mine wants to buy it because he needs a car just to get to work and back, I wouldn't want to sell it to him because I'd say it's eventually going to break down on him and I don't want to inflict this on him. The problem was you weren't driving around in a clunky car. You were driving around in a great car, but you imagined that it was, and so you acted like it was.
Yeah, and I would talk, I mean, so bad about that company to people in my peer group because I didn't want them to inquire about it. And truth be told, I mean, I knew the industry was changing. And it would possibly lead into that clunky car kind of territory.
Okay.
So that was actually a great analogy. I never thought of positioning it like that, but like I said, we were getting squeezed on the wholesale side of the business for the past probably 18 months to 2 years. And then on the retail side of the business, there's a lot of affiliate websites out there, but there's the big players own, you know, the 1% own 99% of the market, right? The StubHubs and that kind of stuff. So it wasn't necessarily the easiest. I guess the future wasn't super bright for the company, which is, I guess, another reason as well.
I see. What about this? It sounds like what you were also saying is that you need for some kind of shakeup, some kind of urgency in your life or else you don't perform. Does that feel right or am I imagining it?
No, you are good at what you do. I mean, that is very accurate. And it's funny, I was listening to an interview with Gary Vaynerchuk and Joe Polish recently, and Gary was talking about like 2 years ago he was considering sabotaging what he had because he wanted that whole like Phoenix from the ashes moment. And it's one of those things that I've always realized the rapid growth of my ticketing business. The reason why I grew so quickly is because every month I put my back up against the wall with those credit card charges. I would put, you know, $300,000, $400,000 a month on credit cards, and I didn't have $400,000 in the bank. I was banking that I would sell inventory on the back end to pay those credit cards, and that's how we grew so quickly. So for me, is every time I extended myself in business, I've always been able to rise to the occasion. And it just, honestly, success feels heavy, right? I mean, at a certain point, you lose the drive for it, and there's this lightness that comes to being a beginner again. And there's other factors, you know, like wanting to prove people wrong. I think subconsciously you want a great story as an entrepreneur because you hear all these incredible entrepreneurs like the Steve Jobs of the world and that kind of stuff that have this huge like rise from the ashes story. I think there's a lot of factors, and sabotage is something that happens to a lot of entrepreneurs, whether they're conscious of it or not. And it's something, you know, we don't necessarily talk about too much. So, but that's definitely, I guess that's what happened in my business.
And one of the things that caused it to happen faster than you would have wanted seems like was the bank. What happened with the bank?
It was. So while we were kind of scaling downwards, I still had a full team. I still had retail stores and stuff like that. I had a hard time letting people go in my business. I kept people on a little too long than I should have. And what happened was I got a call one day from my merchant services provider. And my merchant services provider, basically I had a relationship with them for 5-6 years, never had any problems. And they held a reserve. They held some of my money in a reserve account. So they considered the ticketing business a medium risk business, meaning that, you know, we sell tickets and there's a good chance that some of it comes back as chargebacks. And from a merchant services provider's perspective, if you're selling something and it's not consumed right away, there's risk. And the longer that time is, the more risk there is. So sometimes we're selling tickets for events that are 3 to 6 months away. So originally when we opened our account, they were holding about $100,000 of our money in a reserve account, and they were taking it at a rate of like 10% per transaction until that account was full. So that account was full, and then we got a phone call on like a Friday afternoon from one of the adjusters, I guess, and he said, you know, whoever assessed your account initially assessed it wrong, and because of that, we have to put your account on 100% reserve, meaning that virtually 98% of my business is credit card transactions. Every single penny that I charge through Visa, MasterCard, American Express is going into a reserve account that I can't touch for 6 months after I close my account. So at the time, I was getting married. I had a 6-month-old daughter, which I was still trying to adjust to, and I had this going on, and I didn't have any backup plans. One thing you learn as an entrepreneur is cash flow is a heart attack to a business, right? Your profit is like a cancer you can fine tune over time, but cash flow, if you have no cash flow, you have no business. And I still had probably 15, 20 employees at the time, 2 retail stores, all those expenses and all that kind of stuff. And when that cash flow stops, it probably lasted about 6 weeks, and I wasn't getting anywhere with the bank. And I pleaded with them to talk to somebody to help me out, and there was no resolve until I was actually in the Bahamas getting married, and I was literally like 6 days away from being completely dry, and I threw a Hail Mary, which I wrote an email to a bunch of higher ups in TD. I sent this at the bank, but
they don't care.
Yeah, no, exactly. Don't bank with them. I bank with them still. But regardless, at the end of the day, I sent an email to all the execs and the person who put that 100% reserve on my account, and we were able to get it resolved, and they released some of the money. But by then, the damage was already done, and I already had credit card racked up, and it was a bad place to be. I was hoping to end at zero sometimes in the month, you know, months in the future. However, I hit rock bottom financially really quickly.
And you had to let all these people go?
Yeah, I had to let them go. I tried to do it like one by one to a certain degree, but they knew. I was disconnected from that business for 8 months to a year prior to that. I mean, I used to be in the business first one. I used to be at the office first one there in the morning, last one out at night. And I'd check in once a month. Once every, you know, 5-6 weeks, everyone, like I just randomly show up. And I didn't care. I didn't care how the business did financially. I just did not want to be around it. You talk about like the importance of culture in business and that kind of stuff. I mean, the culture was so bad that I didn't want to go. I didn't want to be a part of
it. What made it so bad?
I think the business grew faster than my skill set, and I hired a few people who were not the right fit. And because of that and my inability to fire them quickly, it was just like a cancer in the business, and I just felt like I was kind of shackled to my own business to a certain degree. And it just got to a point where I had this happening. I had that revelation of how much money I was making versus how happy I was. And I just, again, there was so much going on that I just, I disconnected myself from the business. So I think many of them probably saw it coming. In the end, I ended up having to let them go. And to this day, I'm not sure if they know the whole financial situation that was behind it.
I wonder if they're going to listen to this interview and find out. I'm going to call out Nicholas Clark. I'm going to call out Cyrus Orden.
I can't believe you. I don't know how you do this. You're a good man.
Research.
I tell you.
I was also checking you out as I was reading it to see is he feeling really uncomfortable that I'm reading real people's names or not. And
I'm amazed that this is why I love Mixergy. I mean, you go deep. I've been on a few other episodes and a few other interviews and stuff like that. I mean, nobody goes like this. I didn't know you could do this kind of research. That's great. I'm glad, like you said, like the whole, you know, you want to really make sure you have the right guess and that they're telling the truth.
Totally. You know what? This is the reaction that, of course, someone who had this kind of relationships go through. I've had people who, before an interview, I will say, I can't find a single person who worked at this company that you're going to complain had hundreds of people work in that you didn't like.
Yeah.
I can't even find one person. What's the problem? And they treat me like I am the Inquisition trying to catch them for some kind of faith-based crime. No, I'm just doing my freaking research. It's not that hard to find out today.
Yeah.
Right? And so that also is telling. Like, are they seeing that as a slight against them that I'm actually looking into it? Are they seeing it as a point of pride that, you know, that they're on a place where someone cares enough to look into their past?
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I want to look back into that stuff as well, because like I love to see how I positioned like the marketing for that first company and stuff like that, and what I can kind of learn from that, because I did that business years ago and I haven't looked into it since. So I think it's great you do your research.
Thanks. And one of the hard parts for me was after leaving it, I was so burned out that I didn't say goodbye to people, that I couldn't explain to them what was going on with me, because, you know, it was all on me. And I was wondering for years, did these people from the Bradford and Reed days feel hated or slighted or hatred towards me or slighted by me or something or any of that? And one of the nice things about having done this and saying and talking about my past is that they will reach out from time to time, and it is such a positive, pleasant experience. And I don't know if that happened to you. Did it, where you feel like I'm just not there to even properly acknowledge why I'm leaving?
You know what? It's something I haven't done, and I probably, you're making me think about the whole closure aspect of it. I mean, it would, I still get in touch with these people from time to time. They reach out to me or they like something on Facebook or something like that, but I've never had the actual conversation as to, you know, what really happened behind the scenes. Because again, I mean, it's sometimes I don't think I was 100% transparent with my team at the time, which, you know, transparency is a big thing, especially, you know, with good cultures and stuff like that in business. And you're definitely making me rethink, I guess, those initial relationships, because they've all moved on. This is a few years back now. And, but in hindsight, I could have dealt with it differently and done a much better job.
my experience, people do understand that, and I hope that one of them finds their name in a transcript or something, or that you find them and you somehow reconnect.
Yeah.
I want to just touch on the feeling that you had at the low point. I don't want to make it seem like, well, everyone has these low points and we almost want to have these low points so that we can rise up above them. No, they're, yeah, from my experience anyway, they're very painful. Absolutely. For you, what was it like?
It was the scariest point of my life. I mean, when you go from having a business that is, you know, sometimes doing $700,000-$800,000 a month in cash flow and that's stopping, it's terrifying. You know what I mean? Like, I ended up $250,000 in cash debt with no business, no cash flow, no business ideas. I was 52 pounds heavier, well, 55 pounds heavier than I am now. I was just getting married. I had a 6-month-old daughter, so I was getting very little sleep. I was trying to adjust to that. You know, my daughter definitely threw a wrench in things initially. And yeah, it was just, there was a lot of change going on in my life, and I definitely felt like I didn't have control over it. So it was definitely a tough time. Transition's always difficult. You know, they say when one door closes, another one opens, but it sucks to be stuck in the hallway. And while I was in the hallway, I was in a bad spot financially and health-wise and those kind of things. So it was definitely a bad time.
Were you scared?
So this is the thing. In hindsight, it doesn't seem like it was that bad. One thing I will take to my grave, I wish I would have done, was actually journal during the entire process. I wish I recorded it a lot more than I did, because, again, yeah, hindsight is hindsight 2020. So, I mean, definitely. It was definitely a tough time. It was the whole quote unquote not being able to get out of bed in the morning. That was me. And even if you do get out of bed, there's no point. It's like your life has no purpose, no meaning. My identity was tied to that business. My identity was tied to be somebody successful. And it was terrifying to know that the people, yeah, I surrounded myself were still successful in business, and that I could lose my friends if I didn't hit it out of the park again with another business. And yeah, I mean, again, new marriage. First marriage, but I just got married. Almost didn't have enough money for the wedding last minute. The timing of it was pretty bad. But pulled out of it.
What about debt? I said at the top of the interview that you ended up in debt. What kind of debt did you end up with?
Is a lot of the credit card debt from that company. Once we were able to close the company and close our merchant services account, we were able to secure, we were able to get some of that money back that was in the reserve account. But by then, we already accumulated 6 months of interest on some of these credit cards. American Express, for example, does not play around. If you don't pay your credit card bill within, you know, if you don't pay it by the due date, they close it down and they come after you. And that, you know, when you have, you owe them quite a bit of money, interest builds up really, really quickly. Those kind of things. So that's how I really accumulated that. That was from the business. And I didn't necessarily do the best of jobs initially. Like most people, when you start a business, you just start, hit the ground running, and you do things as you go along, and you're kind of flying by the seat of your pants. And I didn't necessarily do the best job protecting myself personally from the demise of the business. So should things go bad business-wise, I didn't do a good job kind of distancing myself from that, because those credit cards were in my personal name and stuff like that. And I could have done a much better job if I put some thought into it.
And then you carry that personal debt with you even after the company is done.
Yeah.
100%. So let me ask you this.
Sure.
I said earlier that Phil did not like when I did ads, but I've got to do some kind of ad here. So how about instead of me promoting Walker Corporate Law, I just ask you, as a guy who's now been at the height and the low, do you have any legal advice that other entrepreneurs should be aware of? Structuring their company, protecting themselves against the downside.
That's a tough one. I mean, for me, one of the biggest lessons was to have cash reserves. Cash is king. And I mean, Jim Collins, in his most recent book, talked about how, like, the good to great companies, the great companies had 3 to 10 times the cash reserves than other companies. Microsoft, when Bill Gates started Microsoft, he had $1 million. He had, sorry, not $1 million. He had a year's worth of payroll in the bank. That was his rule, that no matter what happened in the business, he had to have a minimum of a year's worth of payroll in the bank. And that's something I never did. Every time money hit my bank account, I was out buying more tickets. I was out buying things personally, those kind of things. I never kept money in the bank. And that was definitely a learning experience. So it doesn't really tie into the legal side of things, but from the financial side, as far as protecting yourself, that was definitely one of the biggest lessons learned.
Okay.
Because banks don't give you money when you need it. That's the, that's the downfall of banks, unfortunately.
Notoriously not. So there you go. If you want business advice, cash flow advice, talk to Jason, talk to other entrepreneurs. If you want legal advice, frankly, the guy to talk to is Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. When you're starting up your company, I think most law firms, and especially Walker's firm, knows that they know that you don't have tons of cash in the bank and that you're just getting started. They'll give you a good deal when you get started because they're basically banking on their relationship with you later on. And when you have that kind of investment where a lawyer puts that investment in you, puts in the time early on, knowing that they're not really making that much money up front, use it properly. Use it to learn what you need to know, to figure out what you need to protect yourself. Those friends of yours who you're going out for poker or drinks or just masterminding with aren't going to have all the best legal advice. You need a lawyer. I hope you talk to, at least, if not, and actually I urge you also to sign up with, but at least talk to walkercorporatelaw.com. Thanks, Scott, for sponsoring us.
Okay. And just on that note, I just want to say that I'm a firm believer that the wisest investment is wisdom. And that's one thing I did wish I would have done initially, was had proper chartered accountants on board with the company and proper legal advice and stuff like that. Because again, it's something we overlook as entrepreneurs because we're like, oh, it's an expense right now and I'm doing so good and we're just forward focused. Everybody I know who, it's easy to make $1 million or a multi-million-dollar company. It's hard to keep it. And there's what really sidetracks a lot of entrepreneurs is those unknowns. And I'm a firm believer that good judgment often comes from experience, and experience often comes from bad judgment. Yeah. So you can leverage the wisdom of others and save yourself that pain. So who knows where I'd be with a Walker in my life.
One of my mistakes was I went with a huge law firm in New York. Huge old school, and they were terrific at doing things like real estate and helping us with agreements. What I was bad at was saying, I should go out for lunch with them and ask them some questions and have them get to know me. I'm paying them. They should be there for advice beyond the specific thing that I'm paying them for, the specific crisis that I need their help with. But I kept thinking, I'm a small fish. This is a big pond. They have bigger players to talk to. They just don't really care about me. And frankly, if they didn't care about me, I should have moved to another law firm. And if they did, I should have done maybe a once a month lunch with them, or once a month meeting at their office that just is, here's what I'm going through. What have you seen? What's going on in your life? And ask them about the people that they're talking to.
I think that's a big thing for me is during that business. And I'm trying to change that now with my new business. I wasn't on top of finances like I should have been. And simply because I was too afraid to ask. And every time I did kind of position and ask, the person who I had hired, I hired in that field, in the financial field, would just kind of drown me with like legal mumbo jumbo that I couldn't understand. And I wasn't kind of driven enough to like dig in and be like, okay, I need to understand the financials and how this works and how balance sheet works and that kind of stuff. So I think what you said, there's a lot of wisdom in that, is being willing to ask, you, especially if you're paying for these people. They can save you a ton of money and a ton of pain, without a doubt. So
I'm on your new website, mastermindtalks.com. First of all, mm-hmm. It looks great. And second, it reads well. I see your wife's influence there. But the people that you have as part of this event, Tim Ferriss, who just goes by the name Tim. There's another guy to the right of him on the page, just James. That's James Altucher, Yannick Silver, Guy Kawasaki, and the founder of FreshBooks, the founder of so many other companies here. Mike, what's Mike's last name?
McDermott.
Mike, sorry?
Mike McDermott.
McDermott, exactly. Yeah, I interviewed him a while back, and I just forgot his last name. Great. Fantastic people here. How do you get into this when you're trying to pick yourself up?
So I never thought I'd be in the event space, first and foremost. What happened was, while I was in transition, trying to figure out what I'd do next, somebody gave me a ticket to go see Seth Godin. And I've always been a huge fan of Seth's, but I've never had the opportunity to see him speak in person. And the theme of his workshop, it was taking place in New York, and the theme of his workshop was the connection economy and how there's huge value connecting like-minded individuals. And at the time, I thought to myself, there's no group or career path as isolating, really, as entrepreneurship, because everybody's working in their own little silos and those kind of things. So I wanted to start these things called mastermind dinners, where I'd invite 6 to 8 entrepreneurs who didn't know each other, and I'd just help kind of facilitate connecting them. And the first one I did, I almost canceled 2 hours prior because I'm like, nobody's going to see value in this. I think I wasted their time. I had all those doubts, you know, almost like a new startup entrepreneur would. And that was the interesting thing, too, is when I was successful in my last business, people with younger businesses or who wanted to transition into business would ask me, you know, I'm scared to do this, or I'm kind of afraid to do that. And I was successful at the time. So I'm like, oh, it's a piece of cake. You know, just grow some, you know, man parts and just do it, right? Just follow through with it. And when I was at my lowest, I had all these fears that built up again, right? The fear of rejection and the fear of what people were going to think and judgment and those kind of things. And that was one of those instances where I was going to start holding these dinners, and I'm like, the people are going to think I wasted their time and that kind of stuff. But thankfully, I went through with it. And I mean, the first dinner was incredible. The conversation lasted like 4.5 hours, and time just flew.
Did you structure the conversation, or did it just happen?
I structure them a lot more now. Initially, I just did intros around the table, and I said, what's your personal brag and your business brag? Like, what's something great you did in your business, and what's something great about you personally? And then also I had asked them, in order for your business to jump to the next level, what's a problem you need to solve? So what's a pain in your business, in essence? And then we just did that, and then the conversation just started to flow.
And how'd you get these people who are so incredible to care enough to come to your dinner?
That wasn't necessarily the smartest approach. I reached out to people cold. So I basically found a list. So a local magazine or a national magazine in Canada posts this list of like the top 200 companies on a yearly basis. So I would just go through that magazine and pick out people who were local, and I'd say, hey, you know, I'm doing a dinner with a few other of these guys. Do you want to join us? That kind of stuff. My response rate was abysmal because I didn't have a relationship with them. And I don't know why I didn't think about it more at the time. But then I started leveraging more people in my network because I already had a great existing network. So I saw it as an opportunity, as well as these dinners went on, to kind of reinforce the relationships that may have kind of gotten a little cold over some time. And then I'd ask them to, if they had a great experience at the dinner, which they always did, I asked them if they want to co-host the dinner with me. And I'd invite 3 people, they invite 3 people, so I can kind of leverage network that way. But yeah, initially I reached out to people cold, and it was a terrible, terrible idea.
That idea of co-hosting a dinner with someone else is a great idea, because then you instantly double your group.
Exactly, absolutely, yeah.
You didn't charge for it.
I didn't, no. Okay. For me, whenever I invite somebody to dinner or have dinner with somebody, I always, it's like they call it pulling a Jason. Like, I find some way to pay for the dinner. It's part of it's like a reciprocity thing. Part of it is I just don't like people paying for dinner. So for these dinners, I was paying myself. So I was, they cost on average $600 to $800 a dinner to host. But I saw so much value being created, I just kept on doing them. And that led me to an opportunity to do an event.
And then the event is where you finally started charging.
Yes. So what happened was, so obviously we both know Tim very well. Tim is probably one of the best book marketers I know.
How do you know Tim? How do you know him well enough that he's going to come to your event?
So this is how it happened. So I went to an event. He had an event called Opening the Kimono 3 years ago now. And that event, initially, that really kind of changed my model on how I view and value high price point events, because that event was $10,000 for 2 days. And that was an event that he hosted. And it was actually geared towards authors. And I never had the intention of ever becoming an author. But I'm like, at $10,000, there's going to be probably some interesting people there. And I was right. I mean, the connections I made at that event were absolutely phenomenal. And then we just crossed paths from that point forward. We had a lot of mutual friends. And what happened, though, was on his blog, so his last book, 4 Hour Chef, got banned from all the Barnes & Nobles. And so he was, I mean, when you're Tim, you have 4 Hour Workweek, which is a huge hit, 4 Hour Body, which is a huge hit. Everybody's anticipating that the 4 Hour Chef is going to be a huge hit. So you have to kind of meet that bar. And one thing he did, which was brilliant, was he did these book packages. And if you bought, you know, 100 books, he'd do a webinar. If you bought 250 books, you do this. If you bought 4,000 books, he had one package. If you bought 4,000 books, he'd do two speaking engagements. And at the time, I thought of a good friend of mine who puts on these huge events in Canada and the United States, where he has 2,000-3,000 people show up to, for these events. And I said, this is a great opportunity for him. So I sent him an email. And the minute I click send, I'm like, you know what? This is a great opportunity for anybody, because it was $84,000 for the 4,000 books. But I'm like, at $84,000, is it possible, just a stretch, but is it possible to, you know, have Tim in two major metropolitan cities and get 42 entrepreneurs to spend $1,000 to spend an hour with him? I'm like, it's possible as like a backup plan. So I said, you know what? I'm going to pull the trigger on it. So I emailed him directly and I said, I'll take it. And I emailed him that morning that he posted it. And I had to come up with the money that pretty much that day, because he was doing the launch. I think it launched, his book officially launched, I think, November 21st. And all this happened like two, three days prior to that. So I had to raise money really, really quickly. And that's when I was able to thankfully do that. I made three phone calls to some friends, and the first two people said, I'll front you the money right away. And I'm a firm believer because of that you never know the value of your network until you really need it. That was the first time I've ever asked anybody for money.
And they gave you what? You said it was overall $43,000, so each one of them gave you $21.50?
I ended up going with one of them, and they gave me the full $84,000.
Oh, 84, I see, okay.
Yeah, so that was the proud owner of 4,000 four-hour chef books, and so I picked a date with Tim to get him to speak, and he was the first speaker I had, and then I built out an event from there.
I see. And then how did you get people to come buy tickets? Usually people who organize events like this have a big following because of their blog. I'm thinking TechCrunch.
Yeah, I was very lucky. As I tell a lot of people, ignorance and confidence can go a long way when you're an entrepreneur. I mean, I didn't know necessarily what I was doing from a conventional perspective. You know, one of the examples is that I reached out to a few friends of mine who put on events, and I said, how much could I charge for an event like this? And everybody was like, you can't get more than $1,000 a ticket. Like, it's not going to happen. So I said, all right, then. So I'll charge $997. So I charged $997 for the first few people. And then I did a simple like A-B test. And I said, I wonder if I charge $33.97, I wonder if anybody will buy. And tickets were selling at the exact same rate at $33.97 as they were at the $9.97 price point. But the best part is the quality of people were better. Because for me, I wanted the right people in the room. I really saw it as a social capital play initially. Because anybody, if you've ever done an event, there is no money in the event space. It's very difficult to make money initially, especially on a first-time event. So I just wanted to break even and just put 100 incredible people in the room. And by raising that price point, again, it was kind of unconventional as far as, you know, for a first-time event to charge $3,000, but it definitely worked out for us initially.
$3,000, but then did you buy ads to get people to come to it? Was there something else that you did?
So there's two things there's kind of three things. So first, we did do some Facebook ads. We probably spent about $5,000 on Facebook ads, so not a huge amount. And we just really leveraged the celebrity of Tim and other speakers, right? So that was the kind of nice thing, is we did have some high-profile speakers who had influence. So Tim, for example, a lot of people, you know, going back a year or two, a lot of people have used his image and stuff like that illegally.
Yes, I've seen that.
And he's come down on them pretty hard. But thankfully, in this case, because he was speaking at the event, we were able to leverage, you know, his personal brand. So we used a lot of Facebook ads towards his audience. But his audience actually wasn't as receptive as we thought they would be. We had a ton of applications from his audience, but there were a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs. And that's not the people I wanted in the room. That's not the people who would get the most value from that event. So that was a kind of an eye-opener for me, because we had 4,200 applications, but there was a small portion of that were people from Tim's audience that were just not the right fit. So we did do Facebook ads initially. We did Google retargeting, which helped a little bit. But the biggest thing that we did as far as moving the needle marketing-wise, and it's probably I spent, as far as all the marketing initiatives we did, I spent the least amount of effort in this one space, and it gave me the biggest return, which was I did an influencer blast. So basically what I did, I actually got this from my good friend Clay Hebert. Mike Del Ponte used it for Soma, to launch Soma. And if you look on Tim Ferriss's blog, there's a post there, how to raise $100,000 through Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. Fantastic detailed post. And they talk about this influencer blast in there. But basically how it works is I would reach out to people in my network. I'd send them to a landing page and I say, listen, would you mind, you know I'm doing this event. If you think it would be of value to people in your network or your audience, would you mind sharing it? Through Facebook, Twitter. So I made it really easy with the buttons and some scripts that they could use. And I sent it out to probably about 50 people. I know 46, 47 of them ended up blasting it out to their network. So that was like the James Altuchers and the Tim Ferrisses. So people who were speaking or high profile people who were attending or people who were friends of mine who had a lot of influence who weren't able to attend or whatever the case may be. And that one campaign had, we had 6,000 hits to our landing page from that one campaign. But the quality of the people who applied and who signed up was like way better than any Facebook campaign or anything like that. So I think that like the social proof really helped in that case. So that was by far, we spent probably the least amount of energy in that marketing campaign, and it paid off the most and moved the needle by far.
And it was people like James Altucher and the other speakers and other high profile guests who were tweeting it out and emailing it out. Is that the kind of thing they did?
Yeah, so Facebooking, tweeting it out, but we did it all within a 48-hour period, because if one speaker kind of blasts it out, then it gets lost in the noise. But, you know, people like, I don't know, like maybe you and I, we follow the same people, right? We follow the Tim Ferriss of the world. We follow the James Altuchers. So within a 48-hour period, if all these people blast that they're speaking at this event or blast that they're supporting this event, people are going to see it, right? Okay. And when they see it, they're like, holy, where's this coming from? It's kind of like Tim did this. I got this from Tim as well. He does these every lead up to his book or something like that. He's everywhere. He's doing interviews everywhere. He's getting media everywhere, and it's all strategically timed within like a 1 week period, right? It's that big spike. And I was kind of taking that principle as well, and I wanted to use that social influence and just do a huge blast for 48 hours.
Okay, I'm looking to see if there's anything else here in my notes on any computer that I want to make sure that we bring up. I think we are good. You made a profit the first time?
We broke even.
Broke even.
Which was initially I thought I was going to make profit. There's a lot of hidden costs and events that you don't know.
What's a big hidden one that you didn't expect?
Well, what's a what? Sorry?
What's a big hidden expense that you didn't expect?
Gratuity on the like the servers and stuff like that.
Yes.
That was a $5,000 bill that I was not. I didn't look through the contract. Again, the importance of having lawyers and legal people looking over contracts. I was not aware of that initially. A few things like that, like unexpected things from the venue that really kind of a little caught me off guard. And if I was being a little safer and a little more conscious, then I probably would have caught it. But we ended up getting close to pretty much breaking even initially. And for me, I wanted to make an incredible event, because I thought if I could make the speakers evangelists of the event and I could make attendees evangelists of the event, I had three videographer crews there. And if I could capture that on camera, I'd have enough social proof that I'd never have to sell the event ever again. So because of that, we have a ton of footage and pictures and testimonials and that kind
of
stuff.
It's one of the first things that I see when I go to mastermindtalks.com. Yeah,
that's a very small snapshot.
I think it's a video that plays on mute at first so that we can get scenes of the event, and then we can click around and sign up. Actually, I see that we can sign up. We can just get notified when the next one's going on.
Yes.
Before I say goodbye, first of all, I appreciate that you're doing this, and I appreciate all the that you notice the research that goes into this. I want to say to the audience that we have over 900 interviews available on Mixergy, almost all, thoroughly researched. I say almost all because everyone makes mistakes, and I can't imagine that I've got it all perfect. But I do know that I do I'm going to say it like this. I do a fantastic job of finding guests and researching guests, and part of it is by learning from what I see from the mistakes that other people make, by constantly improving our processes here internally. We have a process for looking you up, for finding out where you get your traffic, for seeing where people talk about you. And all that's developed over the years because I am trying to appeal to and attract and help out people who are real entrepreneurs. And real entrepreneurs are not going to deal with the BS, well, shucks, I built this business and now life is great. They want to know specifically, what did you do? They want us to go and dive deep until we find that Twitter strategy or the influencer strategy that worked for you. And that's what Mixergy is all about. And you can find that through interviews, all, like I said, thoroughly researched or what we call courses. Again, taught by entrepreneurs, all very thoroughly researched. A lot of work goes into them. And if you've watched this far, I urge you to go to MixergyPremium.com, sign up, and at least try it. If you're not happy, you know me. Jason knows me. Everyone in this community knows me. If you're not happy, you ask for a refund. If I don't give you a refund, one of these guys is going to slap me upside the head. But it's never happened, and I don't believe it ever will, because I believe you're going to be happy, and I know that I will do whatever it takes to keep you that way. All right, MixergyPremium.com, go sign up, including you, Phil. All right. So if, Jason, people come to the site, is the goal just to get them to apply, to enter their email address, then they get to apply later on? I feel like you're just kind of hanging out with me, but there's no call to action that I could give people. There's nothing that I could tell them to go check out if they want to be a part of your universe.
Yeah, no, if they opt in there, we will notify them should spots become available. We may have spots this year. What happened with last year's event and the word of mouth that has happened from last year's event, I mean, we're in a very good position and we're keeping it very intimate. It's still going to only have 120 people in attendance, and we still have a lot of the applications from last year to go through and stuff like that and reach out to them again. So we'll see. I mean, we're hoping that we can sell out the event. We're just starting to send out invites now, and the response has been great. But we're hoping to sell out the event without doing any marketing.
Who's the big speaker this time?
Guy Kawasaki is one of the he's going to be competing, and then we're building out the other speakers
That's
now.
That's the other thing you told me I didn't know before we started. You said, Andrew, all the speakers are rated by the audience who picks the best speaker, and these guys are all competitive, so they produce because they want to win. So it's possible that Guy Kawasaki, being the headliner, could give a presentation and lose to someone else who's not a headliner but works even harder on the presentation.
Let's put it this way. So that was a great thing about what happened at last year's event, because the first place winner, second place winner, and the four people tied for third, none of them were the draws for the event. They were all unknowns. And it was great from a brand perspective, because it really showed that you don't always have to bring the big names in order to deliver massive value.
But who's obviously, the big winner?
His name is Joey Coleman. He has no online influence at all, but he gave an absolutely killer talk. Absolutely killer. He did a creative live course, which was amazing. Like, he's incredible at what he does, and everybody's on him to kind of ramp that up, his online presence. But I don't even think you could find that much on him.
Turning customers into fans in the first 100 days. That's the one that you're talking about.
Yeah, that's his creative.
And I see something on YouTube promoting it. All right. Joey Coleman, congratulations to you.
Yeah, you know, he did a fantastic job. So that was the beautiful thing about it. So, I mean, we're hoping that we can get to a position where we're hoping that this year we don't always have to bring the big names. We can bring, because we have enough brand equity that people know, and we built up enough trust with our audience that they know that we'll bring people who will deliver massive value. I had an opportunity to pull the trigger on Guy Kawasaki, and that guy just has a magnetic smile, and I'm like, I want you, even if you don't speak, I just want you in the room. So he'll be at the event in June.
What did you do with all those books? You still have them at home?
They're in Denver, Colorado. I mean, I don't know what to do with them, in all honesty. I mean, I had a friend of mine who bought a bunch of books as well, and he built a fort. I'm not sure as to what to do with them yet. I still have probably about 3,500. I'll figure something out in the near future. At the last event, I tried to give three per person, but they're the size of like an encyclopedia.
They are very big books.
They are very big. They are very heavy, so people didn't want to lug them around. So unfortunately, we didn't move them that way. But hopefully, we'll find a way soon.
Can I tell you what an obsessive person I am? I'm now looking up Joey's information. I see designsymphony.com. That's his company, right?
Yeah.
Okay, hang on a second. Let me see if I could find his email address right now. Otherwise, I'm going to ask you. Let's see. Oh, actually, I can't do it now. We have a format for finding people's email addresses. We gave it out in one of the courses, so I'll try that later.
Yeah, he's incredible.
And if, barring that, can I hit you up for an introduction to him or some of the other guests?
Absolutely, 100%.
I would love it. Thank you so much for being on here. The website for everyone else is mastermindtalks.com if they want to follow up. And if you do go to the conference, say hi for me. Or maybe I'll even come up to the conference. But please, let people know if you see them on Mixergy that you appreciate what they did here and get to know them. Cool. One of the benefits, I'm going to keep talking way too much here, but one of the benefits that I'll say is a lot of people who do events offer me affiliate revenue, and I say, I can't deal with affiliate revenue. The benefit of that to the audience is all the goodwill that comes from the guest to me that they can't pay me with cash, they end up showering my audience with affection because they say, well, Andrew's not going to take money. I'm so grateful to him, but here's this guy in front of me who came to me from Andrew. I better take really good care of Andrew's audience so that Andrew will have me back on and I'll have all that goodwill coming back to me. All right, I'm gonna be done with all my yapping. I better actually go and do some real work here. For now, I will say, Jason, thank you so much for doing this interview.
I really appreciate you having me. Thank you very much. And thank you for all your research. Again, I think it's really honorable that you've been doing this for so long, so many years, and you still have this level of attention to detail. I was a big fan before. I'm an even bigger fan now.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys. Oh.